I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Novel. I read a lot of romance novels. People have a tendency to make fun of them, mostly because it's a genre largely targeted towards and written by women. Romance novels are full of hope, humor, and yes, sometimes there's really steamy sex. You like dragons and elves? You want to know what it looks like when a whole hockey team finds love? Maybe you'd like a fictionalized version of an Amish courtship. Or what would it look like for a rabbi to fall for a former sex worker? Romance has it all, pumpkin. There's even a world where Italian gangsters learn there's more to life than money and violence. I'd actually never read any mafia romances before I came across Eunice's story, so I figured I'd pick up a few. For research purposes, of course. I asked my Twitter followers what they liked about mafia stories and got a variety of answers. People are fascinated by the strong sense of loyalty, the found family narratives, and the protectiveness, plus the secretive nature of the community. And there's much to be said about sidestepping government overreach. Everybody loves sticking it to the man. Add in the myths about Italian men, their appreciation for good food, good living, and good loving. And well, it can be hard to resist a good mob romance. A lot of these images that feed into the lore of gangsters were shaped by Eunice and Dewey's conviction of Lucky Luciano.
Okay, a brief synopsis of America's fascination with the Italian mafia, if I may. In the 1930s, when the Lucky Luciano trial first started to hit the local papers, life imitated art, and art imitated life in those days.
Until the trial of Lucky, there may have been rising public panic about the seeping influence of crime and corruption on American life. But the gangsters themselves?
American people started to pick up sympathy for these guys. You've got this crazy dichotomy between people fascinated with the mob and people who hated and feared the mob for very good reason.
We can thank Hollywood for that.
Those early gangster movies were based on real-life crime figures.
In the early 30s, Hollywood is churning out film after film about anti-hero gangsters, whether it's Edward G. Robinson playing Rico in the 1931 movie Little Caesar.
Now listen, Rico, I'm going to talk to you, but you're not going to hear a word I say, see?
That would have been Al Capone.
This is inside dope, and if it gets out, it'll be just too bad for somebody.
Or Humphrey Bogart as Duke Manti in The Petrified Forest, released in 1936.
Did you think I was kidding when I said I'd be glad to knock you off?
People all love The Petrified Forest because that's Dillinger, you know? Bogey really nailed it.
You're all right, pal. You got good ideas. I'll try to fix it so it don't hurt.
By the early 30s, a die was cast that people wanted to see the gangsters.
The government, unsurprisingly, doesn't like this.
The gangster is being seen as the hero. We've got to stop that. We've got to stop that.
So the government starts promoting their own style of hero in films.
Now we're going to make movies about G-men, you know, government men, the FBI agents. I don't think the public ever really bought that.
After all, having the law as heroes doesn't exactly fit with most people's experiences.
The general attitude towards criminality come 1933 is, well, the gangsters, in fact, in many ways, they're better than the police. At least they're not being paid by the state. They're not taking money and being paid by the state, so they're cleaner than that.
Then there's Dewey with his investigation into the mob. This mustachioed crusader works hard to frame Dutch Schultz and then Lucky Luciano as public enemy number one. Dewey does start to have some success here, changing public attitudes. He begins using radio broadcasts and newspaper headlines. And the hype of Lucky's trial helps chase away any lingering doubts the public may have about how bad the mob is. By the time of the guilty verdict, the legend of Lucky Luciano and his downfall is being broadcast triumphantly across America. The gangster who revolutionized the mob has been taken down. The boss of bosses laid low. The original Godfather. But even as Lucky is led away from that courtroom in handcuffs, people are already starting to question the lines between the truth and fiction.
Lucky Luciano, who is this guy? Who was he? For real.
When it comes to Eunice and Dewey's prized mob conviction, is it possible the whole story of Lucky is a fraud? From the teams at iHeartRadio and Novel, I'm Nicole Perkins, and this is The Godmother. Episode 7, Disorganized Crime. On June 18, 1936, 12 days after Lucky Luciano was found guilty on charges of compulsory prostitution, he returns to court for sentencing. Dewey, Lucky, and the other co-defendants push past the crowds and step into the Manhattan courtroom. There, they all stand before Judge McCook. A judge, you might remember, who had been specially appointed to take on organized crime.
They were set on putting these guys away for as long as they could, particularly Luciano.
A few weeks ago, Lucky had been all arrogance and swagger as he took to the stand in that same courtroom. But if he'd been surprised by the jury's eventual guilty verdict, it was nothing compared to his slack-jaw shock as Judge McCook reads his sentence aloud to the courtroom.
Holy Toledo! For prostitution, you're giving me a life sentence?
Lucky Luciano took the harshest term from Judge McCook.
30 to 50 years in prison. It was a life sentence.
Once all sentences have been handed out, Lucky and the other defendants are taken away for processing.
It was quickly determined they needed to be split up and sent to different prisons so that they couldn't reorganize this sex trafficking gang.
Lucky heads upstate to a prison on the Canadian border.
Up the river, as they say. He wasn't taken down by taxes like Al Capone or Waxy Gordon. He wasn't shot in the head by a rival like Dutch Schultz. He was brought down by a bunch of two-bit whores. Most men in the underworld insisted it could not be true.
In the end, it's the women who bring Lucky low. Lucky might be down, but he and his team of expensive lawyers are far from done. Because, let's face it, the prosecution's case hadn't exactly been watertight.
At best questionable, if not downright illegal.
So as that summer of 1936 passes, Lucky's team starts to work on their appeal in an attempt to swiftly free Lucky from his new home up the river. And while they're working on that, what is Eunice Carter doing?
What she does after Luciano's trial, Thomas Dewey's team continues to investigate organized crime.
She and Dewey are back in their office on the Woolworth Building's 14th floor. She was a relative rookie when she joined Dewey's investigation, but Eunice harbors ambitions of becoming a judge one day. It's a lofty goal on any scale, let alone for a Black woman in the foothills of a vast mountain of systemic racism and sexism in America. But I wouldn't be surprised if Eunice thought, why not? Her career as a prosecutor was off to the best possible start with a high-profile Lucky conviction. It's easy to imagine Eunice back in her office, desk light burning her eyes, as she goes back over every piece of evidence in preparation for Lucky's appeal. She has to know everything will be called into question. It was her original work that got the conviction in the first place. She may not have received kudos in public, but if Lucky won his appeal, the prosecution's loss will definitely have her name all over it. By 1937, Lucky's lawyers think a do-over might be imminent. There was one obvious weakness in his original conviction: the witnesses.
The underworld had a strong self-interest in pressing the narrative that these women were unreliable witnesses.
It wasn't just what the witnesses had said on the stand. It's the way Eunice and Dewey had coaxed that testimony out of them in the first place.
So they were effectively held against their will incommunicado unless and until they cooperated.
Lucky and his team are well aware of just how shady the coercion of testimonies had been from the witnesses. In fact, most of America is becoming aware. The public has been reading a slow trickle of allegations that had found their way into the newspapers. Some of the witnesses who had cooperated with the prosecution are now talking to reporters about their experiences. I wonder if Dewey's composure cracks away from the courthouse as he reads the newspaper over his breakfast each morning. Maybe he worries his mustache into disarray, wondering who could be leaking all of this information. Readers aren't just learning about brutal coercion. Eunice and Dewey may have turned the bad cop dial up a little too high, but they'd also been using the good cop routine.
It is certainly true that the ones who were willing to talk were given special treatment. They didn't have to stay necessarily in the jails. In some cases, they were put into secret apartments.
Dewey's assistant prosecutors was taking the girls out to bars and getting drunk with them.
I'm pretty sure Eunice wasn't the assistant prosecutor taking the girls out, but who knows?
The idea of wining and dining the ones who were released from jail was fairly outrageous.
And the newspaper reports are now alleging that this coaxing of the witnesses didn't stop with simple nights out on the town. Apparently, certain promises were made to the witnesses about rewards after a positive conviction.
Several of them received emoluments that were highly unusual. Two of the women were sent on a cruise around the world, paid for by Dewey and his prosecutors.
When the trial began, Judge McCook reminded the jurors of the sex workers' humanity, but maybe he should have delivered that message to the prosecution as well. These witnesses had been exploited at every turn by their customers, the mob, the prosecution, the defense, and now the press. Everyone wants these little birdies to sing for their supper with promises of gilded cages for protection. But there's no real safety after you rat out the mob, is there? The good guys want you to be grateful, as if they saved you. The bad guys want you punished. And the press wants you to keep singing. But all those gilded cages flake and rust. So which one do you choose? There's no way to be truly free, is there? Dewey and his team are about to learn the hard way that some of their key witnesses are falling back into the hands of the mob.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Cokie Flo was one of the prosecution's key witnesses. You remember Cokie. She was going through detox on the stand. Cokie's testimony, like nearly all the witnesses, had put her life in great danger. No one likes a snitch, especially if they're pointing fingers at the boss of bosses. But if Dewey was worried about the safety of Cokie or any of the rest of the women, he didn't show signs of it, at least not in his media briefings.
His press releases afterwards were more of a justification of what had been done during the trial. He was very mute on what steps were being taken to protect the women after the trial.
When Lucky is convicted, Cokie and Millie Harris, one of the other trial witnesses, understandably decide to get the hell out of Dodge. They flee upstate to Rochester, New York, and hole up in a cheap hotel. breathing fresh air, and looking over their shoulders.
They began writing these stories that they were hired to write for Liberty Magazine.
They were offered the magazine deal in exchange for their life stories.
The series of stories was called Underworld Nights.
Liberty Magazine is a popular magazine that features stories from people of all walks of life, including celebrities, politicians, and former sex workers turned prosecution witnesses. The series of articles is published.
Once they finished that, and they were paid for that, they couldn't go back to New York to their old lives, so they decided to go on a road trip. And they bought a car. They took the southern route out to California.
California because Flo and Millie aren't just magazine writers now. In the aftermath of the trial, they'd also been offered a movie deal.
They were under the impression that this film deal was imminent, and they wanted to be in L.A. when the film deal went down.
The ladies don't end up in Tinseltown right away. Maybe they want to make their money stretch a little longer or try their hand at living straight, because before long, they're living in Pomona, just outside of L.A., and they're getting short of cash because they've spent their remaining money on a kind of a strange new business.
They decided to open a gas station in Pomona, of all things. And the two of them opened a gas station, and they ran it for a while. And Cokie Flo was okay with that.
But for Millie Harris, it's not so simple. Hollywood tends to take its time, and the film about their lives still hasn't come about yet. And the gas station Pomona life isn't quite what she'd anticipated. I'm sure it lacked all the glitz and glam of New York City. And she's a city girl. Plus, she's carrying an emotional weight.
She wanted to get back to New York. She missed her husband.
A husband she had helped put away alongside Lucky,
who was in jail in Sing Sing.
Maybe the guilt is eating away at her because
Millie Harris, without Cokie Flo's knowledge, started communicating with the lawyers for Luciano, who were handling his appeal. And an investigator wanted to get her to recant her testimony, which she did.
Eventually, both women returned to New York together, back to their old lives. Cokie goes back on heroin.
She became an addict again. They both went into a sanitarium to try to fake the cure to get off of heroin. And it was during that time that they signed these affidavits recanting their testimony.
Sometimes the fear of something new is as much of a prison as anything else. By March 1937, all the prosecution's key witnesses have officially turned. Eunice and Dewey have lost the very foundation of their case against Lucky, and Lucky's defense is picking up steam. All they have to do now is get these recanted statements in front of an appeals court, get the conviction overturned, and then Lucky will be a free man. Dewey is clearly worried about this, too. He re-enlists Eunice as his assistant for an April 1937 hearing for a retrial. But Eunice, Dewey, and Lucky haven't factored in Judge McCook, that belligerent, dedicated, anti-mob judge who had already come up with his own plan for this turn of events.
McCook did something that was highly unusual.
You see, back in June of 1936, when the Blue Ribbon jury had dropped the bombshell of Lucky Luciano's conviction, when Dewey was striding triumphantly from the courtroom and Eunice was, well, not there as the drama played out, another scene was also taking place. This one behind closed doors. Judge McCook, instead of taking a well-earned break after ruling over the trial of the century, is in his office, surrounded by sex workers.
After the verdict, and while the motion for new trial was pending, he called all 70-some women who were still in jail into his chambers.
These 70 women are the sex workers and madams who have been witnesses in the trial. And this isn't some post-trial party.
And without any notice to the defense or without any defense lawyer being present, on the record, with a prosecutor present, he made them reassert their testimony.
All 70 women are told to swear again that their testimony was accurate.
Highly unusual to do that. Outrageous, actually. The case really reeks of prosecutorial misconduct, at least by today's standards.
These women don't have a cushy life at the start of Lucky's trial, and we know it took a lot to persuade them to testify in the first place. Their lives leading up to the trial had been severely uprooted, and it probably didn't get any easier after their names had been dragged through the press. Plus, I imagine the mob and their defense attorneys probably weren't very sweet when it came time to convince them to recant. It's been one harrowing experience after another, and now recanting their testimony means nothing. Lucky's defense team tries everything they have to get the case invalidated. In fact, by October 10th, 1938, they've taken this all the way to the highest court in the land.
The conviction was analyzed by the appellate and was denied for an appeal. They denied a retrial and they denied a mistrial.
Thanks, in part, to Judge McCook's early intervention.
Judge McCook, I'm not saying it was a crooked trial. I'm just saying in 1936, don't be a high-profile criminal. They put him away in a manner that today standards, I would hope, wouldn't hold water.
It was not fair, but it was considered fair for its time.
Dewey and Eunice's triumph is now set in stone. It looks like Charles Lucky Luciano is stuck in jail for the foreseeable future. And as he languishes there, while his lawyers try and fail to win an appeal, Eunice and Dewey are already busy again. They both continue their fight against organized crime, although with very different results. Eunice is now diligently prosecuting numbers runners in Harlem.
She winds up taking down some numbers racket leaders in Harlem, which is sort of met with mixed feelings within the Harlem community.
Eunice's success on this front isn't met with blanket approval.
There's definitely a lot of people who are very happy because they do not want there to be criminal activity in their community. But then also when you look at the newspapers, not only Black-owned papers in Harlem, but across the city, there's editorials that are like, why is this woman targeting her own community?
In order to get ahead in the predominantly white world of law and justice, Eunice has to prosecute people who walk the same streets as she does. It's a fine line. I imagine she has to prove to her white colleagues she won't be biased in her work, while also trying to prove herself trustworthy to her Harlem community.
We talk frequently today about the constraints on Black womanhood in the public eye, right? We know that Black women are subjected to more critique, to more hate, to a different set of standards than other people. This pressure from within the Black community to be a representative of the race would also presumably have made Eunice Carter feel pressure even when she wasn't in white spaces.
During this time, whenever Eunice Carter opens the paper and sees her name, it's not with professional accolades or recognition in the society pages. She reads judgments of her loyalty, her character, and her image. The newspapers that used to praise Eunice now judge her as harshly as any jury. Meanwhile, Dewey is receiving a much more positive reception in the media.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpert.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
By the end of 1937, Thomas Dewey is no longer a special prosecutor. He gets sworn in as one of five New York district attorneys with the power to decide who gets prosecuted. The law was only ever a stepping stone. He wants to break into politics. The following year, he's on the move again. He runs and loses a gubernatorial race. But in 1942, he runs again and is successfully elected governor of New York. His dreams of political office have come true. His rise is, by any standards, meteoric. He's ridden a wave of popularity that followed Lucky's prosecution far higher and faster than many might have expected. How did he manage it?
Now, in cooperation with police and federal law enforcement departments throughout the United States, the only national program that brings you authentic police case history. Gangbusters!
In the immediate aftermath of Lucky's trial, Dewey is not shy about trumpeting his performance.
He gave his reports on WNYC radio. He also regularly gave interviews. Dewey, by 37, 38, was in the news. He was the guy who put Luciano away. He was the gangbuster.
Gangbusters is a law versus gangster fact-based radio drama. It first aired in 1935. It's a program that Dewey becomes associated with by 1936. In 1939, a book called 90 Times Guilty is published. It tells a now-familiar story of Lucky Luciano as a shadowy mafia figure pulling the strings of the underworld, a criminal mastermind. Hickman Powell, a former political reporter for the New York Herald Tribune, writes the book while working for Thomas Dewey as a volunteer speechwriter and researcher.
90 times guilty. Came out with the idea that Luciano had centralized, organized, modernized the American mafia.
It's a great PR strategy for Dewey to lean into.
He knows the victory over a kingpin boss is going to be incredibly good publicity for him.
The only problem is,
this book was largely fiction.
It combines some of the hype about Lucky that Dewey has been feeding to the press with some new tall tales.
The idea that Luciano organized crime in America because he'd killed 60 to 80 greasers, as they were called, old-style mafia gangsters, it gives credence to the idea that he was a dominant figure in organized crime in America nationally. It was just a completely made-up story that true crime writers ran with.
And it isn't just these scenes of vicious mob murders this book has fictionalized. It's also cementing a bigger lie about Lucky, too.
So I'm not trying to be the cheerleader for Lucky Luciano, but I realize the opposition had a self-righteous, zealous campaign going, and they needed a poster boy.
If you want to make your name, there's no point in putting some small-time hoodlum from downtown Manhattan in prison. That's not going to make you famous. But you get the boss of all bosses of the mafia, and suddenly you're all over the papers.
Dewey needed to position Lucky as the one true face of crime in America. It was vital for people to think it had been Lucky pulling all the strings. And now that he's been taken down, the war on crime has been won.
By the end of the 1930s, with Dewey's success, as well as Hoover's success, American newspapers were saying, well, we've beaten organized crime. And of course, they hadn't.
The book is part of a winning career political strategy for Dewey.
There's something to be said of criminal poster boys, your El Chapos, your John Gottis, your Frank Lucas, your Lucky Luciano. Who makes them that? Are they really the face of the problem? Poster boy for whom?
Dewey's plan of using an anti-organized crime crusade to get to power has been used many times since. Remember Giuliani versus the mob in the 90s? Dewey and his subsequent imitators are able to gain traction because they are tapping into an already existing rich current in America.
White supremacy is absolutely central to organized crime. I don't think you can discuss one without the other.
Lucky, arriving into the squalor, poverty, and xenophobia of the Lower East Side of New York, is an ideal candidate.
And a lot of the mafia stuff is a reworking of nativist ideas. Bad in America has to come from somewhere else. It's foreign. It's the other.
We still see this today, right?
If it is organized crime within America, it's by so-called immigrant groups. It's Mexican narcos. It's Russian mafia. It's the mafia. You don't tend to think of organized crime as being American. I think what happened in the 1920s and 1930s was this drive to demonize people in a way that really hadn't been attempted before.
Organized crime is totally and only to do with Italians who got the brawn and Jews who got the brain. You know, using those ethnic stereotypes, which is essentially the analysis that the US government followed, and certainly true crime writers.
So you get this fertile ground for Dewey's projection of Lucky as the mafia boogeyman, an evil puppet master responsible for all of society's ills.
If you create a super demon, you're more likely to get funding, you're more likely to get political power, you're more likely to remain in political power. And also, if you screw up, you can say, well, how on earth do you expect us to be able to deal with this? They're all over the place. They're far too big for us.
There's a career opportunity for prosecutors in America that do tend to use their trials and convictions to advance their political prospects. And I'd argue the prosecution of Lucky Luciano was, to use London terms, a fit-up.
In other words, Lucky's trial was rigged. So what is the truth about Lucky Luciano? Was he truly the godfather of the mafia?
Categorically no.
Not at all. An important career criminal who knew other career criminals became rich enough during Prohibition to be able to afford hotel rooms in the Waldorf Astoria. But the mythology stems from Dewey calling him the greatest gangster in America. He was a career criminal, an extortionist in a city full of extortionists.
It's not that Dewey and Eunice had the wrong man. It was that there never really was just one mafia puppet master controlling all vice and organized crime. One thing Lucky is guilty of, though, with his scarred face, sharp clothes, and ritzy address, is standing out.
If you dressed better and had nicer cars than the governor, people notice. And if you have a wow factor that makes enemies' ears perk up, you're going to become that de facto face of everything those people are out to get.
Government like to make the battle against organized crime good versus evil. We are the good guys, they are the bad guys. But there's so many different shades of gray.
This framing of Lucky as the boss of organized crime is still the way we understand the mafia today. It doesn't just come from Hollywood's portrayal of the mob. It also comes from a deliberate manipulation of the public and the law. It's a falsehood that originates as much from our criminal justice system as it does from those L.A. writers' rooms Millie and Cokie Flo wanted to get into.
I mean, The Godfather was a great film, but for me, a great misrepresentation of the issue of organized crime in America based partly on the Luciano legend.
Why is it that Luciano has this reputation that he doesn't deserve? Well, the answer lies really with Thomas Dewey. Dewey manipulated the press very successfully. And that mythology has never really been challenged sufficiently, I don't think, to this day.
But what about Eunice Carter? How much is she on the hook for this too?
A team player, which is a good thing. But not necessarily if you're in a team that is involved in manipulating justice for political advancement, which it was in Dewey's case.
Eunice Carter was probably a good fit for Thomas Dewey's office because she too was career motivated. She had bigger barriers and hurdles to jump just because of who she was. I believe she was probably as determined, if not more, than Dewey to carry out their vision of justice.
But for Eunice Carter, Thomas Dewey would not have been able to convict Lucky Luciano. I don't know that Luciano would ever have been convicted of anything.
I guess you could say Eunice Carter is the godmother of the Godfather. But while this undercurrent of American life is giving Dewey's career a seemingly unstoppable upwards trajectory, unsurprisingly, it isn't having the same impact on Eunice. And as America enters the 40s and Dewey's career continues to take off, Eunice's professional life seems to languish. In 1938, Eunice is named to Dewey's staff to lead something called the Abandonment Bureau of Women's Courts. Here, her time is spent on cases covering everything from divorce and marital issues to custody and child support. She'd stay there until 1945 with none of the upwards career trajectory she'd hoped for after Lucky's prosecution. I can't imagine Eunice's disappointment as she watches her boss Dewey reach his professional dreams based on the success of the case that could not have happened without her. Actually, yes, I can imagine it. Sadly, it's an old tale. If Thomas Dewey refuses to grab drinks with his colleagues so he can keep working, he may have been seen as dedicated and focused. If Eunice Carter refuses, she's seen as not being a team player or trying to show up her coworkers. And if she does, she could be dinged as not taking her work seriously enough. How is she supposed to know how to get ahead if every step is used to hold her back? The struggle of navigating a predominantly white, predominantly male field is enough on its own. But add in the concerns of your own Black community. Why are you a prosecutor? Why aren't you looking out for us? Eunice's mettle is probably tested on a daily basis. And as a Black woman, she's expected to show uncommon resilience. She can't control what people think of her, so it wouldn't surprise me if she focused on what she could control, her pursuit of a judgeship. But in the 1940s, Eunice is not really seeing the rewards of her work. Eunice has stayed close to Dewey, and Dewey has his sights set on a political win far higher than governor. He's inching closer to the White House. Surely, it's just a matter of time before he brings Eunice along with him, right? He's become a bit like found family for Eunice, brought together by the intense, complicated loyalty of the mafia. But family can also be a source of betrayal. If Eunice hadn't learned that yet, she was about to find out. That's coming up in episode 8 of The Godmother. On this episode of The Godmother, you heard...
Hi, my name is Ellen Paulson. I research and I write books about women who were involved with notorious gangsters and desperados.
My name is Christopher Allerfeldt, and I work for the University of Exeter. I've published 2 books and several articles on organized crime in the United States. I tend to specialize in the period from 1865 to 1941.
My name is Christian Cipollini, and I am an organized crime historian and author.
My name is Robert Whalen, and I'm an emeritus professor of history at Queens University of Charlotte here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
My name is Chuck Greaves. Before becoming a writer, I spent 25 years as a Los Angeles trial lawyer. My 4th novel was basically a fictionalization of the famous 1936 Vice trial.
I'm Debbie Applegate. I'm a historian and biographer, and I am the author of Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the Jazz Age.
I am Claire White, and I am the director of education at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas.
I'm Sarah J. Jackson. I am an associate professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and an affiliate with the Africana and African American Studies program here.
I'm Mike Widdiwis, author of Organized Crime and American Power, and I teach at the University of West of England. And I think with Christopher, we are professional historians who look at the issue of organized crime in particular.
The Godmother is produced by Novel for iHeartRadio. For more from Novel, visit novel.audio. The Godmother is hosted and written by me, Nicole Perkins. Our producer is Leona Hamid. Additional production from Adjua Jima Brimpong, Ronald Young Jr., and Zayana Yusuf. Our editor is Adjua Jima Brimpong. Additional story editing from Max O'Brien and Mithili Rao. And our researcher is Zayana Yusuf. Additional research from Muhammad Ahmed. David Waters is our executive producer. Field production by Tanita Romani and Palace Shaw. Sound design, mixing, and scoring by Daniel Kempson. Our score was written, performed, and recorded by Jeff Parker. Music supervision by Nicholas Alexander and David Waters. Production management and endless patience from Cherie Houston, Sarah Tobin, and Charlotte Wolf. Fact-checking by Fendel Fulton and Danya Suleiman. Story development by Madeline Parr, Jess Swinburne, and Zayana Yusuf. Willard Foxton is our creative director of development. Special thanks to Leah Carter, Stephen Carter, Angela J. Davis, Andrew Fernley, Marilyn Greenwald, Sandra Lebedee, Catherine Godfrey, Nadia Mady, Amalia Sortland, Sean Glenn, Neil Krishnan, Julia Bromberg, Katrina Norvell, Carly Frankel, and all the team at WME.
Novel.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my hosts as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.